Okay, the title. Well, let's leave the title for the end. But I wanted to actually do something a little different tonight, and that's to ask seven questions. Okay, or maybe eight. Question number eight. We'll start with is. Maybe we'll touch upon also why go to Poland. So if anyone's still deliberating, try touching that also. Question number one: what is the meaning between the behind the battle of Yaakov with the angel, which Chazal tell us is the Sarosh of Esav? Okay, the spiritual representation of Esav that comes into the world and battles it out with Yaakov. What is the meaning? What's behind the message behind that? That battle. Question number two is why does the angel change Yaakov's name? At this point, Yaakov seemingly defeats him, although it doesn't defeat him completely, because he is injured and he walks with a limp as a result. He injures him to get an usher. We don't even get an usher as a result. But at that point, he changes Yaakov's name. And he says to him, "Vayomer lo Yaakov yemer o chimcha ki im Yisrael ki sarisa im Elohim v'im anashim atucha." They're not going to call you Yaakov anymore. This angel says to him, "We're not going to call you Yaakov anymore, and rather we're going to call you Yisrael because you have fought with God and with people, and you have overcome them." So why does this angel, who again is a representation, spiritual representation of Esav, change Yaakov's name? And then the more fundamental question, which many ask, is why, if Yaakov's name was changed, and then again, Hashem himself, when he speaks to Yaakov later on, blesses him, he also repeats this idea that we're not going to call you anymore Yaakov, Vayomer, where is it in Pasuk? Vayomer Elohim, it's Pasuk Yud, Perek Lamed Hey, Pasuk Yud, Vayomer Elohim, Shimcha Yaakov, Likari Shimcha Od Yaakov, Ki Im Yisrael Yeshem Echa, Vayikra Shmo Yisrael. That Hashem himself repeats this blessing and says, we're not going to call Yaakov anymore, we're going to call Yisrael. And yet, as we know, Yaakov continues to be called both Yaakov and Yisrael. When Avram's name was changed, or Sarai's name was changed to Sarah, we no longer refer to them by their old name. And yet here Yaakov's name is changed by the Malach, and then again by God, to Yisrael, and yet we still continue to call them both Yaakov and Yisrael. It's a question, it's an interesting question to ask. We're not really going to answer the question, a little bit maybe. But why sometimes is he referred to Yaakov by Yisrael? But follow, why does he keep both names? And when the Torah does refer to by Yaakov, why is here Yaakov and why is here Yisrael? Why does the Torah choose in those particular times to choose that particular name? Is a bigger question that we'll just maybe touch upon, but it requires actually more analysis. Question number, I think we're up to four, is why is the dots after he confronts Esav, vayaratz Esav lekraso, vayichabkehu, vayikolat savra, vayishakehu, vayivku. Esav runs to greet him, he hugs him, he falls on his neck, vayishakehu, and we have, in the Torah, you have these dots that appear, in the kudot that appear on top of the word vayishakehu, vayivku, and they cry. What are these dots supposed to represent? Yaakov, question number five. When Yaakov is praying to Hashem, so he asks in Hatzilenina Miyad Achi Miyad Esav, save me from my brother from Esav. Again, this is a well-known question. Why does he repeat? It's unnecessary. He only has one brother. So why does he say, save me from my brother from Esav? Just say either my brother or just from Esav. Why Miyad Achi Miyad Esav? Question number six is the Gemara in Chulin on Daf Tzadi Aleph, actually talks about a number of the interesting diyukim from this parsha, from this particular parsha. And one of the things that the Gemara says here is machlokes as to what did the angel look like? The angel that fought with Yaakov, what did he look like? So there's actually two opinions in the Gemara here. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani Amar, Ke'oi Kochav Nidmelo. He looked like an idol worshiper, a non-Jew idol worshiper. 300, definitely you can understand that he's the representation of Esau. That is, makes sense. And then, Rav Papa Mishmei Derava Bar Ula Amar, Kitamut Chacham Nidmelo. The other opinion in the Gemara there in Chulin is that he actually appeared to be a Tamut Chacham. That the Sarshal Esau, this angel, appeared to be like a Tamut Chacham, like a, you would imagine a rabbi, right? Maybe he had a black hat, maybe he had a long frock. And that's how he appeared to him and started this battle with him. What is the nature of this machlokes exactly that we have here in Chazal? And then finally, last question, number 7 or 8, we throw in the poem question, what's Yaakov, it says, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, Yaakov remained behind. Everyone else crossed over and he remained behind by Yivater Yaakov Levado. And Rashi quotes the Medrash here, Shachach Pachan Ketanim V'Chazar Lehem. He forgot Pachan Ketanim, little vessels, and he went back for them. What's going on? The little vessels, he forgot, little jars. That, what are they worth? It's nothing. So he risked his own, put himself in danger, which in fact that's what happened. He ended up fighting with his Sarshal Esav because of these Pachan Ketanim, these small vessels. Is Yaakov so cheap? Is this where we get the whole idea that Jews are cheap from? Is it from this that he went back to Pachan Ketanim? I mean, we suffer for thousands of years from jokes, bad jokes. That Jews make about how cheap we are. That people make how cheap we are. Because Yaakov is so Pachan Ketanim? And Chazal say, because Tzadikim, Chazal, the Gemara in Chulin says, it says, "Mikamet tzaddikim shechavu aleim emanim yosar migufam." The Gemara itself says it. The Gemara says that tzaddikim, their money is more valuable to them than their own lives, than their own bodies. Really? Does that make sense? Jews are so cheap. Like they say, what's a Jewish catch 22? It's a famous joke. Jewish catch 22: free hand. What about the rabbi, his buddies with the local priest, actually the shul and the church are right next door to each other. And whatever they, they talk about any good sermons that they gave and good ideas with each other, they share with each other. So one day, one Sunday morning, the priest calls the rabbi and says, "Listen, I got this doctor's appointment. And I want to know if you'd be able to cover for me in the confessional box. Just whatever. People know the difference. You're behind this thing. They won't see you. And but I don't know what to do. It's fine. Come with me. Well, I'll start you out. And then once you get the hang of it, I'll go. I have time anyways to catch my appointment." He goes, "Okay, listen. I'm going to help out my friend." So he goes there. The two of them are sitting behind the curtain. And they're waiting. All of a sudden, this woman sits down and says, "Forgive me, Father, if I have sinned." And the priest says, "Yes, what is my child? Because I committed adultery." Okay, how many times? 3 times. Okay, so put $5 in the charity box and say 3 Hail Marys and you'll be forgiven. Okay. About 10 minutes later, a man comes in and sits down, says, "Yes, what is my child? I committed adultery." "Really? How many times?" "3 times. Okay, the priest says, "Put $5 in, say 3 Hail Marys, and he'll be forgiven." So the rabbi turns to the priest and says, "Okay, I think I got it, I understand." He says, "Sure, yeah, no problem, go ahead, don't worry." So he's waiting there. Half an hour goes by, finally, woman sits down, and says, "Forgive me, Father, for I've sinned. Yes, what is trial? What? I committed adultery." "Really? How many times?" She said, "Oh, just once." So the rabbi says, "Oh, well, actually, we're running a special this week, $3 for $5, so you can go and do it 2 more times. So, is this where we get this reputation from? It doesn't seem to this Gemara that to say about Yaakov Avinu going back with Hakim Tanim. What exactly is going on here? Obviously, there's something much deeper going on. So, Yaakov, in the beginning of the parasha, when he prays Hashem, he says, "Hatzileini yam yad akim yad esav." Yaakov is actually worried about two distinct dangers. And this is, again, Maisa Avos, this whole parasha is Maisa Avosim Labanim. This is a representation of what our forefathers went through, that we, the children are going to actually experience and be worried about for all time. So Yaakov's worried about two dangers. Two approaches that Esav is going to come. Miyad Achim, Miyad Esav. On the one hand, he may come to me as a brother. The other hand, he may come to me as Esav. Two types of dangers that Esav poses to us. One is the obvious danger, and that's Esav. Esav, son of Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov. He wants to destroy him. He's an enemy. He's coming with 400 armed men against men, women, and children. So that's an obvious fear. That's the fear that Yaakov has towards Esav. It's physical danger. But there is another type of fear that Yaakov has. And that's if Esav HaRasha, comes to him as a brother. Comes to him to destroy him, but destroy him disguised as a brother. And this danger is actually a more sinister type of danger. Because it's a much harder to fight. It's much harder to rally the troops around this kind of a fight when they're coming to you, embracing you, and with appearances that they love you. And we have a machlok in the Chazal when it says Vayashkehu, so there's these dots that appear on top of that word Vayashkehu, and Rashi quotes the machlokas in Chazal, which is also found here in this Gemara, that what is Vayashkehu? There's two opinions. What is Vayashkehu? One opinion, and again, very diametrically opposed opinions. One Vayashkehu, all know, is that he didn't come to kiss him, he came to bite him. Okay? Vayinashkehu, he wanted to bite his neck. Okay? He came to kill him, and he wanted to bite his neck. And we know that the Nedr says that his neck turned to marble. That was the Esav attacking Yaakov, the physical danger. But the other opinion there, quoted in Rashi, is diametrically opposed. He actually kissed him. And it was an expression of love, expression of brotherhood. Two opposite extremes. However, the school of Kutz, which you'll find the students of Kutz, is some of them, two of them, the Shem Yishmuel, Reb Shmuel Bornstein, who was the Sachet of a Rebbe, his father, the Avnei Nezer, was the son-in-law of the Kutzke Rebbe, Menachem Mendel of Kutz. The son-in-law was the Avnei Nezer. And his son, the Shem Yishmuel, has a fantastic, beautiful parish on the Torah. And he was also became the Sachet of a Rebbe. And he and both the Sfas Emes, was the son of the Kedusha Arim. Kedusha Arim was one of the main, if not the Talmud Mubhak of the Kutzke Rebbe. Both of them say the same idea, that the kiss that Esav was giving to Yaakov was not a kiss of pure love. It was actually a kiss that was more dangerous than the bite. It was a kiss that tried to connect to the tzaddik Yaakov, which could be more destructive than actually being physically hurt by the Russia. But as we said, Yaakov's neck turned to marble. Why specifically marble? Could have turned to a lot of different things that are hard and won't won't accept a bite. Marble, koin talapa, shayish. Marble is not mekabel tuma. And so it turned to marble as a way to push away the tuma that Esau was trying to infect Yaakov with. So the Gemara Nechulin similarly has smachokas about the appearance of the angel of Esau. The Sarosh of Esau, the machokas is, did he look like an Ovid of a Zara? Did he look like an idol worshiper? Or did he look like a Talmud Chacham? Again, the same parallel approach. There are two ways that the Sarosh of Esau can appear to Yaakov. There's two machlokas seem to be diametrically opposed, but perhaps not really so diametrically opposed. They're saying that the two approaches that Esau came, or the spiritual representation of Esau, sometimes he comes direct assault, the non-Jew who's assaulting the Jew, but sometimes he comes with the appearance of the Talmud Chacham. Where that is an enemy that is much more dangerous because he looks like he's one of us. He's on our side. When you know the enemy, so there's a battle that's waged, and again, you can fight him head on. But when you don't know that the enemy is an enemy, the danger is much greater. They appear to be our friends, but they want to help us. But that's a real dangerous enemy. There was a movie, you've seen, it's called Face Off. John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. Doesn't ring a bell with anybody here? Good, Hashem?
Isha.
Okay, what?
I said
Isha. No, it was a movie. Okay, anyways, I don't want to ruin the movie for you. But basically, one's a good guy, one's a bad guy, and they actually trade faces. They literally trade faces. John Travolta goes undercover looking like the bad guy, Nicolas Cage, and Nicolas Cage, where they thought was dead, comes back to life and takes John Travolta's face. And so that is a much more dangerous enemy when you think he's your, you know, he thinks you're you know this guy, and he's actually the meanest criminal that there is, and he looks like your dad, and looks like the head of police, and that's scary. Okay, I'm gonna check how many downloads of YouTube it's tomorrow. Okay, anyways, the double agent is much more dangerous than even, you know, obviously a head-on enemy or even a spy. When you think he is on your side and he's working for someone else, that's very, very dangerous. And so the Talmud Chacham, he's just like a Talmud Chacham, is a very dangerous type of a fight, because you think he's a friend and he's actually getting you to do something just the opposite. And even the word, the Gemara there in Kulin says, the word vayaveh ishimo, that they struggled, actually some learn it to refer to vayichabeh, that he hugged him. That at first he came with a hug, a bear hug, oh, we're buddies, and then he tried to kill him. Again, the same type of thing, that there are two approaches that Esau takes. Esau comes with, sometimes he comes with a head on, know your enemy, right? And then sometimes it comes that you don't realize he's your enemy. It comes as a friend, and that can be very, very, very dangerous. And so when we look at the deeper idea here, it's clear that one of the things that we learn out from here, and the Sfarim learn out this deeper idea, is that Esav to us represents that koach in the world that's our enemy. And we have an enemy, everyone has an enemy inside each and every one of us, known as the Yetzer Hara. And the Yetzer Hara sometimes comes as as Esav, and sometimes he comes as our brother. Sometimes he comes as a Ovi Kochavim, and sometimes he comes as a Talmud Chacham Yetzer Hara does. That sometimes he comes as a Yetzer Hara will suggest things that appear to be mitzvah, they appear to be good things. He's saying, do this, it's a mitzvah. And we say, yeah, he's right, it's a mitzvah. And yet, he's actually coming to do more damage, much more damage. He gets us to do that, and we're in his clutches, and he gets us to fall very far. It's much more damaging than the obvious sin that he thrusts upon us. Okay, and we'll give you some, let's give some concrete examples to this. Okay, this is an easy one. It's so easy that it seems like. But you'll have this all the time. Like guys will get invited out for meals. Right? Guys get you have your parents' friends coming. And they want to take you out. And he's missing night sitter. It's not, they don't just try to get in Wednesdays between 4 and 8 for some reason. They want to pay you out. So you'll rationalize. You'll say, you know what? This is important. It's actually keep it out of hand for me to go. Because these are my parents' friends, and it'll mean a lot to my parents if I take this meal. Right? And you know what? And they'll probably be insulted if I don't take this meal. All right? And it sounds like very good rationalization. The Yetzer Hara is saying, you have to do this. You have to go. It's more important than night sitter. This is more important. It's just out of respect to your parents. You should take this meal. But it's actually coming, the Yetzer Hara is coming as like this big tzaddik. But he's getting you to do something that was missing night sitter, and then when you're already out, so you do something else. Whatever, just leads you one to the other. By the way, it's a good litmus test. If what I choose to do, when I give the base medrash, and I do it because I think I'm doing something good and important, the good litmus test is what happens afterwards? Where does it lead me afterwards? If it leads me, that I do that thing, let's say I go to that meal, and then the feeling I have after is that I want to go right back to the Beit Midrash, then maybe you can say that was good. Because we have this idea of mitzvah gereres mitzvah. A mitzvah brings on the mitzvah. But the rule, if after going to that thing, you decide, if you leave the Midrash, do this thing. And then after that, you decide, you know what? I'm already out. Let me go. I'm going to go to Cinema City to catch the VIP show. Still some room left after that meal. Or whatever, I'm going to go hang out with my friends, whatever it is, what you're going to do. It didn't lead you to something holy, then you can assume that it follows the rule of aver versus aver. Now, it's not an aver in and of itself. You know, in a vacuum, going out for a meal with your parents' friends is not necessarily aver, but when compared to what you could have been doing, we call that a sin. In the sense, again, it's a sin in the sense that you could have done something, been doing something better. And that's how the Yetzer Hara works. That's a very simple example. Okay, let's give more concrete examples that maybe to me are a little bit deeper. Sometimes you have, this is a machlokes that happens in the Jewish community. Sometimes, a lot. Happens a lot, actually. Okay, there's two, in your shul, there's two groups that are fighting, should we rehire the rabbi, not rehire the rabbi? Or whatever, there's a big machloket, let's say, in terms of hashkafot, in terms of outlooks. Haredi versus Sioni, and many different permutations of these types of machloket. So we get the impression that it's a mitzvah to talk Lashon Hara about the other side, about the other group. Any group that's opposed to your position, it's important. You have to expose them. You have to show them with the sheker of that other group and speak Lashon Hara about the other group. Machlokes is legitimized. And unfortunately, this is something that we've seen time and time again from all sides. From all sides. You know, we suffer from it in the sense that sometimes we speak Lashon Hara about the other side and sometimes they speak Lashon Hara about us. And everyone thinks that it's totally legitimate because they're the other side. They're wrong. So we have to... We have to show how terrible the other side is. Or, but what's very, very prevalent that we find in our own personal lives is the Yetzirah telling us that after doing a Aveda, it tells us how awful we are. And he tells us that we should be so upset at ourselves, and even to a point where we become depressed. We get a sense, I can't do this. I can't do it. You convince yourself how terrible you are. This oldest Svarim, oldest Hasidic Svarim, talk about this. And Siva Shalom, for example, has a... We'll talk about it later on in a few weeks. We'll talk about Shogavim. Talk about this idea more when we get to Shogavim. Most of you don't know what that is. In a few weeks you'll learn what that is. But the Siva Shalom writes that the depression that comes after the Avera, after you do something wrong, is really the goal of the Yetzirah more than the Avera itself. Because at that point you give up. Okay, if I can ask you to put away your phones, listen to this. It's a very important idea. Okay? And that is that often, and this is the goal of the Yetzirah, you do something wrong. It happens. We all make mistakes. But then what follows it is much more sinister, is much more damaging than the Avera itself. It's found in, again, many Svarim, that depression itself, what's called atzvut in Hebrew, depression, it sounds like clinical, which can be clinically depressed, but atzvut is like a state of melancholy, of sadness, of self-defeatism, where you feel like you're nothing, you feel like I'm a loser, I can't do this. So that itself is not a sin, but it leads to every other type of sin. If a person thinks that he is worthless and there's no value to him, that God hates him, that will lead to every other kind of sin. And similarly, simcha itself is not a mitzvah per se, but it leads to every other mitzvah. If a person has the simcha, he has simcha sachayim, he feels good about himself, he feels life is good, he feels he has something to offer the world, then that will be a positive thing to encourage him that he can fight any other battle. You know, it's well known that Napoleon, when he was so successful, perhaps one of the most successful, if not the most successful, general, leader of the army, in the non-Jewish world. And one of the things that they studied, the success of Napoleon, one of the things that they found Napoleon did, which is different, Shlomo, you with me? Which is different than every other army that they were fighting at the time, is that he had, and now all the armies do this today, is that he had, along with, the fighters and generals and all the military experts, he had attached to every group of soldiers, he had attached to them a group of jokers and musicians. That when they, between battles, that they would entertain him. And it would be the simcha. Literally, they would listen to jokes all night, and they would play songs, and they would dance and drink and feel good about themselves. And many historians believe, military historians believe that that was the reason for his success. That he fought the toughest battles, and his army defeated other, on their home court. They were fighting, in their house, in the other people's house, and they won. They weren't familiar with the terrain because they went to simcha. Every other army was frightened out of their wits, which is a normal thing when you're fighting a war. And yet they went in singing and dancing, and that's intimidating. It's intimidating when you're playing another team and they're like, they're so cocky and so confident. I remember, where's Dennis Dwight? He's not here. Shocking. But his father came to visit last week. So his father's Solly Dwight. So I remember playing against him in high school. And he was throwing it down. It was a JV basketball, and he was throwing it down. It's intimidating. When during warm-ups, the guy is just, he's like, we're never going to beat these guys.
We beat him.
Well, we lost them in the playoffs, I think, if I recall correctly. But that's very intimidating. The other team is like just looks like so cocky and so confident. And that's how Napoleon ran his arms. Simcha itself can lead to the fulfillment of all the other mitzvah. And the truth is that Rav Pinkus writes in his Sefer Shabbat Kodesh, so he writes that one of the things you find in the Torah is that we have many terms for the word simcha. The Torah, in Torah, we have many synonyms for happy, joyous, simcha, sasso, gila, rina, ditza, vechedva. The natural state of a Jew is to be the simcha. You have a lot of synonyms for a word when it's something that's very shy to you. Okay, so for example, it's known like the Eskimos have like six different names for snow. Okay? How many names do we have for snow? One, I think. Snow. But they have six different names for snow because that snow is their life. So they have there's a word for hard snow, soft snow, cold snow, warm snow, I don't know, yellow snow. They have a... Because they have so much, that's snow is their life, so also simcha. We have six different words because it's such a shayach to what it is to be a Jew, is to be a simcha. It reminds me when I was spent a few summers at Camp Masora. So one of the colleagues that I had in Camp Masora is now Rosh Hashiva Agon, Gach Yudin, Rosh Hashiva Shreinu. So we used to sometimes we'd go off campus in the summer, we'd go to play tennis and not to be disturbed by, you know, our wives. So we would go like into Guilford, New York, which is like one of the reasons not to go to Missouri is how far it is from civilization. So whatever, we went to Guilford, New York, there's some tennis courts in the park there. No one there plays tennis. And so the courts are always free. So we would play. So we were playing, and I was beating him, and he... it's not so important to the story, but... anyway, so he yells out, and he goes, I'm playing like manure! And use that word, manure. And and there was like a couple of local kids who were playing in the park. So one guy hears him, and he says, what kind of manure? And we're like both like lost for words. What kind of people? Obviously, when you work in it, if that's your life, you have many different types of manure. It's not one type of manure, it's many different types of manure. Which reminds me of there was a guy who's he was running for office in one of the Montana Dakotas. He's running for office, and he comes, you know, campaigning on an Indian reservation. Okay, he comes and he has a few advisors with him, and they're basically, you know, as they're approaching Indian reservation, you know, you'll make certain campaign promises to them. Yeah, okay, fine. He goes up there. People are sitting in this auditorium. And he starts saying, you know, if I'm elected senator, I promise you that we're gonna push for more casinos on Indian reservations. And the whole place goes, hoya, hoya. He looks at his advisors, what's hoya, hoya? He goes, I don't know. He goes, but, you know, keep going. And if I'm elected senator, I'm going to make sure that American Indians get better treatment and we'll get jobs. And we're gonna cut taxes. The whole place is going, hoya, 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 hoya. They love me, they love me. Keeps on going, hoya, hoya. So after the speech, he goes, one of the leaders of the reservation says, you know, he's taking for a tour of the reservations, and they're driving around, and he sees in the distance, he sees like a bunch of actually like bulls, like off in the distance. And he says, you know, I actually grew up on a farm, and you know, we actually raised bulls ourselves. Do you mind if I go have a look, you know, at the quality of your bulls? He said, no, it's fine, just careful, don't step in any of the hoya hoya. Which reminds me of another incident of a guy who comes into the doctor's office. Perhaps you like this one. Guy walks into the doctor's office and he's got a 5 iron wrapped around his neck. And the doctor says to him, "What happened?" He says, "Everything's going great. I was out golfing with my wife. And sure enough, on the seventh hole, she slices one into a, you know, into a field of where there was a herd of cows. So both of us were looking for her ball. All of a sudden, I look, and it, like, out of the backside of one of the cows actually appeared to be her ball. And I lift up the tail, and sure enough, her ball is lodged in the backside of this cow. And that's when I made my mistake. He says, "Why?" He says, "Because I said to my wife, 'Hey, honey, look, this looks like yours.'" Okay, anyway, so the Yaakov Meir was considered to be like the gadol in the world of wrestling today. There's a sefer called the Niftam, a very beautiful sefer. And he also similarly talks about how the Yitzhara gets us, tries to get us even to do things that, to do certain mitzvahs with chumras. And often these chumras are beyond our reach. And the Yitzhara trying to get us, like the Talmud Chacham, go do this, add to this, you know, dress this way, do this. And in doing so, he adds his chumrah, which ultimately is beyond our reach, which then leads us, because we're not successful, we find that we fail in this area, and it leads us to depression, to this state of melancholy. And it sucks the life out of us. Simcha is such an important component in our ability to be successful Jews. And that's, by the way, why we tell jokes here. It's not stomp for entertainment. In Breslov Hasidus, there's a whole big thing about being the simcha, as you all know. Mitzvah Gedol Yos the simcha is tributary of Nachman of Breslov. And Nachman and his students would tell jokes. Better to tell jokes, even milsa d'shtusa, silly things. Like most of the jokes we tell here. It's because being the simcha gives you a much better state of mind to be successful as a Jew. But the Yetzirah is there and he criticizes us. He says, "Oh, you're nothing, you're zero, you're useless, you're like," and it sucks like that. Now here's an amazing thing. The Shlach Kadosh, which amazing shlach. This will knock your socks off, this shlach. You will not be the same after hearing what the shlach has to say. The shlach is found in, he has a parish on the Torah. Not so easy to read the shlach. Shnei B'chol Sabris is a shlach. And Rabbi Shaya Harwitz, he was a rabbi in the Kubel, lived in Prague. Actually, I'm descended from the shlach. There's probably many of you in the room here that are also descended from the shlach. I imagine who's not in the room here, you can see. Sammy Harwitz is probably descended from the Shlach. Anyone last name Harwitz is probably goes back to Shlach. Especially if you're a lady, for sure. Is he a lady? Does anyone know?
He's
a lady. He's from the Shlach, he's missing this. But the Shlach says, when Yaakov went back to the Papan Tani, he says, "You know what the Papan Tani was? Anyone want to take a stab? Maybe you heard this before, because it's so amazing. That those small vessels, you know what he went, you know what they were in those small vessels? You take a guess? Kislev, small vessels.
Oil.
The Pachim Katarnim says a shlach, they actually were little vessels filled with oil. And those Pachim Katarnim traveled with the Jewish people. You know, the history of Jewish people, down to Mitzrayim, out of Mitzrayim, survived all, even the gullus of the first destruction of the temple,
And it's these tachin kohanim that the Greeks were seeking to destroy. And they were almost totally successful, except for there's one pach that remained. And the Tachanayim went and tried to search, desperately search for that pach. Whatever remaining pach they could find that dates back to, way back to Yaakov Avinu. That flask was a symbol of the Nitzrios of the Jewish people. And therefore the Greeks were desperate to destroy it. And the Hashanayim turned over the whole Yerushalayim until they found it. And they rededicated the menorah with that pach katan, with that pach shem. Why did it play such a pivotal role? So listen carefully. The Chassam Sofer has a very, very sharp insight. The question we ask, why does Yaakov remain with two names? Yaakov and Yisrael. Why did the Malach, the Sarshal Esav, change his name to Yisrael? So Chassam Sofer says, very, very sharp insight. Despite the fact that the Gemara Brachah says that anyone who calls Abraham and calls him Avram, he sins. We don't say that about Yaakov and Yisrael. And why is that? Because Yaakov needs both names. He needs both the name of Yaakov and the name of Yisrael. So listen to this. Yisrael is the name that refers to the Jewish people when they are in a high state of spirituality. When they're in a high. You know, we all experience Jewish people, certainly, and each one of us as individuals, we experience up and downs. And when we're on a high, we hear a great cheer. Or we got up in the morning, we got to meet on time, we had a good morning Seder, we feel good about ourselves. That's called the state of Yisrael. We feel, that's Yisrael, that you've struggled and you've overcome. That's the state of Yisrael. And Esau, the Sarshal Esau, was willing to give Yisrael the name Yisrael. But only the name Yisrael. I'll give you, when you are on a high, when you are spiritually high, I can't defeat you. You're the man. I leave you alone, because I can't defeat you. But you know when the Sarshal Esau wants to defeat us, and he knows he can defeat us? That is when we're in the state of Yaakov. When we're in a low state, We have our ups and we have our downs. We have our peaks and we hit the valleys sometimes. We didn't get up. We somehow didn't hear the madrich and we get up late and we feel I had a good thing going. And now I'm back to my old self and maybe this isn't for me. And we feel that's the state of Yaakov. And the Sarshal Esav wanted to get rid of that koach of Yaakov. He says, forget about it. Jewish people, you shouldn't be called Yaakov anymore. You shouldn't have the koach of Yaakov. Yaakov is from the lashon of Eke, right? From the heel, from the lowest part of the body. We have a koach there as well. The Jewish people have a koach even when they're down in the dumps. And the Sarshal Esav says, no, I don't want you to have that koach. The koach of Yisrael, because how many times really are we Yisrael? Most of the time we're Yaakov. And Hashem passed it differently. The Torah passes differently. We need both names. We need Yisrael because at times we mamish, we feel good about ourselves. The Jewish people are in the high. Our greatest moment in our history was Shlomo HaMelech building the first Beis HaMikdash, and then perhaps riding the wave of Hanukkah for a few years, 200 years, until everything collapsed. But most of the time we were in a state of Yaakov. Certainly for the last 2,000 years, we've been in the state of Yaakov. At least up until 1948, perhaps. And then we have what's called Medinat Yisrael coming to... But when we're in the state of Yaakov, we need that koach. We need that koach to understand that even when we're down, even in the low, we still connect to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So a person isn't always in a state where he feels it. And a person has to stand, even when he doesn't feel it, he's still connected. He still can tap into that koach called Yaakov. This is what the Chassam Sofer says. It's such a beautiful insight into our condition. And that's exactly what the Sarshal Esav didn't want us to have. He knows he can defeat us. He thinks he can defeat us when we're down. And they try to defeat us when we're down. So the period before Hanukkah was actually a very, very difficult time for Jewish people. When we say Al Nisim, we say Bimei Matis Yehu Ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Hashmai Vanav. Chazal tell us, Matis Yehu, the son of Yochanan, who is the Kohen Gadol, he was the Kohen Gadol for 80 years! 80 years! In the Kodesh Kedoshim! And yet, after 80 years of Kohen Gadol, he became a heretic, Chazal tell us. He became an unbeliever. Imagine a Kohen Gadol, a person who has access to the holiest of holies, and imagine what it does to the morale of the Jewish people. Most of the Jews left Torah Judaism for Hellenism. We were ma'atim, chalashim. We were the small number, weak against the majority of Jewish people had opted to do it, to join up with the Greeks. And yet, the Chashmonaim came and showed that one must never give up. There is a flask of oil going back to Yaakov, and it must be found at all costs. There are lows, but we're not going to despair. We need to tap in to that koach of Yaakov, to that one last flask of oil that exists. They lived through the darkest period, yet they knew that flask of oil was an attachment to that koach of the Avos, to the koach of Yaakov, and that they can bring light back to a very dark world. And that's why the Rambam says about the mitzvah of Nechanukah, Chaviva hi ma'od ma'od. It is so precious in the eyes of Jewish people. It's one of the holidays that everybody celebrates, even the Jews that are so far. They're living in darkness, and yet everybody celebrates Hanukkah. Even all the people mentioned in Adam Sandler's song. All three versions. And this precious mitzvah shows the endearment of Klal Yisrael to Hashem in every situation. I think we've answered all of our questions. Why go to Poland? So we'll end with the following thing. The following story, which is... It's one of the greatest stories that you'll hear. Maybe you've heard it before, and it's worth hearing it every time you hear it. You'll hear it again, probably sometime during the year. But the Nazis, who were descendants of Esav, descendants of Amalek, there's no question that they were trying to destroy and put out the flame of the Jewish people. And so I mentioned here a few weeks ago, I told you the story about the Blush of a Rebbe. Rabbi Yisrael Shpira, who was the Rebbe of Blushev. And he was in a number of different camps. He was in the Yanuska labor camp. He was also one of the few people that's actually not so well known. But he also was in Belzec. There's only three survivors of Belzec, entire camp, Belzec death camp. There's 600,000 Jews who were killed. And he's one of them, which not many people know that he was one of them. And he finds himself now in Bergen-Belsen, which was in Germany. And the days leading up to Hanukkah were some of the darkest days in the history of Bergen-Belsen. And Nazis always chose to pick the Jewish holidays to make action and to do hurt the Jews in a more sinister way, because again, there's a way to knock us while we're down. When days that we think we have hope, that's hurt them even more. And so the days leading up to Hanukkah, they had a whole roundup, a whole action in Bergen-Belsen, and they gathered men, women, and children. And outside the barracks of where many of the Jews were, just right outside, they just beat, shot, killed hundreds and hundreds of Jews, and left the bodies just in heaps, piles of bones and skin. just for everyone to see. And in that backdrop, it's Chavdala Nisan. Hanukkah. Sorry, Chavdala Kislev. It's Hanukkah. And a number of Jews gather together and decide we're gonna organize a candlelight. Word gets out, and so one of the guys who works in a factory manages to get some grease. Another guy takes his clog. They put this like coagulated oil or grease into the clog. One of the guys takes some threads from his uniform. They make it into a wick, and the word gets out, and hundreds of Jews gather. Obviously, the penalty of death. They gather together in one of the barracks. Just outside the barracks is this heap of bodies. And they ask the Blizzard of Rebbe, or the Soul Spirit, to honor them, to say the blessings. And there were, again, hundreds of Jews packed into this barrack at night. And the rabbi gets up there, he takes, lights a match, and he starts to make the bracha. And he makes the first bracha, the Havi Nei Shulchan. And he makes the second bracha, Shal Samitim Lava Seinu. And then, before he makes the third bracha, he looks around, hesitates, and then he proceeds to make the bracha of Shechtianu, V'kiimanu V'giyamu Z'manazeh, and he lights the candle. And as they're singing very, very quietly, Haneiros Halalo and Malos Tzur, one of the Jews comes over, I forgot his name. He was not a religious Jew, but they call a free thinker. He comes running over to the Rebbe. And he says, Spira, I can understand that you can make the first blessing, Lahabik Ne'er Shulchan. I can even understand, you know, the idea of making a second bracha, Shas, Nisim Lava Seinu, right? And you know, that they should make Nisim for us as well. But how dare you make the bracha of Shechianu v'kiimanu v'giyanu zman hazeh? We're blessing God that He's brought us to this time, to this place. How dare you bless God when our brothers and sisters are lying outside in heaps of bones, and you dare make this bracha blessing God in such a situation? And the Blizzard Rebbe turned to him and said, "You know what? I thought just like you." And that's why, after I made the first two brachas, I hesitated. And I looked to see the other rabbis, to see if I should continue. And then I looked up and realized there are hundreds and hundreds of people here. Hundreds of people here that came to participate in lighting of Hanukkah candles in the worst hell known to man. That despite the fact that they lost their whole existence, and the Nazis have tried to destroy us, they want to take part in the blessing of Hanukkah candles. And I realize that perhaps there's no greater time. What I'm witnessing here is no greater time than to make this blessing. That the Jewish people, despite the lowest, we're in the lowest state we can possibly be in, we still attach ourselves to the Creator. And so I bless Shechianu, V'kiimanu, V'giyanu, Z'manazeh. And he was comfortable. He was not a religious Jew. He accepted the answer. And Judah is, that story sums up the experience when you go to Poland and you will see the lowest state the Jewish people have ever been in. The tremendous Chil Hashem. We were vermin, we were treated worse than animals in every sense of the word. And yet, you will hear how the Jewish people in that lowest state, that state of Yaakov, maintained their connection and didn't lose perspective. And from the ashes, from those heaps of bones, emerged from the state of Yaakov. And just 3 years later, and many of those Jews, those same Jews, and you meet one of those Jews, they turned Yaakov into Israel. They came into Israel. And now the Jewish people Aren't you sitting Yisrael? We're not finally. We still have periods of Yaakov like we had 2 weeks ago. But there's been more Yisrael than Yaakov in our history in the last 2,000 years, that's for sure. And that's the experience. You're going to feel the Yaakov, but you're going to also feel the greatness of the period of Yisrael that we're in right now. Have a good evening.